David Boxley, you mentioned that his way of speaking, Sim Shian, is different from the other guy. He seemed to, the language to me, I couldn't tell a difference just because I don't really hear people speak Sim Shian. But is he learning in Metlakatla or?
I don't know where he learned it from. He could have learned it from some elder, you know, in Metlakatla as a boy, or even his mother. His mother spoke it fluently. His mother's my aunt, my dad's stepsister. No, not stepsister. Stepsister in a way, because his brother was adopted into that family. So in that kind of connection, he's like an uncle. My dad was adopted into another different family. All his brothers were spread out like that, you know, through adoption. So my dad was Hayward. He was a Bucks in the Middle East. Adopted the Hayward family, and then his youngest brother was a Buxton going into a Bolton family, and that's who Boxley's related to.
I recognize Bolton. Don Bolton lives in Hunan now.
There's a Don Bolton before that that's older than I am. He's could have been like maybe a relative to him, I guess.
So the language, you can see the difference between the old dialect and the new dialect.
Right.
Do you think it's closer or getting better towards the older dialect?
I couldn't tell you that. You know, it depends on, I think if we're lucky enough, we see that the Sim Shian language will get used on a daily basis, on a routine basis. It'll come back, you know. But I don't see that happening, you know, because it's like a losing battle. It's just going to get further and further away. The reason I say that now is like my dad's generation was among the last that used it fluently. And all that generation, as they died off, you know, they got less than us people to talk to using it, and after a while it's not getting used, so maybe there's just a handful of them remaining, of those people, so they never get to use it, and they got nobody else to use it for, because the younger generation hasn't learned it. So, but then there's a few, you know, not enough that I think can make a difference, to bolster the return of the Sim Shian language.
Do you think that like Steve Alaska's involvement in making tapes or other people making tapes is helping?
It could turn the tide, I think. You know, if it's pushed, I think I know for me, if I want to be proficient in it, that's the route I'd take. I'd go to see Alaska and or this one woman I know, Sumner, Donami Sumner. She teaches it. And she's a little younger than me, but she grew up with her parents and grandparents that used it all the time. And so she was properly trained, you know, in the use of it, I guess, you know, through the family. And now she teaches it. But I haven't had a chance to talk to her and get her opinion as to how it's progressing. I just from going home, you know, for a while, I was just going home maybe once or twice every 3 or 4 years. So I haven't seen any change in all those years that I've been going back, say over the last 40 years, I haven't seen any change other than the fact that there are more younger people using it, or have learned it, but they're, again, they're not enough of them around to be able to use it on a daily basis. You know, they've learned it like boxing when you heard them on. There's just not that level of usage by anyone, you know, to have them maintain it, you know, to the point. Now, even though I think like the Donovans, you know, the Summers and the Boxleys, various other people from back home, I would say that the people that use it back home, or would use it if they could, I could count on my hands, which isn't very many. You know, so it's got to be, to me, or my way of thinking, if there was hundreds of people back home that use it on a daily basis, they'd be using it all the time. And that's the way it was when I remember my dad and them, when they talked to each other, that was used 80 to 90% of the time they communicated. Now, you don't hear it anymore. Only time you'll hear it is in some kind of a function like what you saw there. And that's not enough.
I think that's starting to get more common with the native cultures, like different regions. You have people that are using it only for a potlatch or some occasion, whereas it would be nice if everybody was able to speak it on a daily basis and keep working at making it better. Like having the language immersion classes throughout the summer doesn't really, that only helps for that time period, that time frame. Because I see a lot of that going on offered for Haida, Tsimshian, Tlingit languages and other languages up here, but 3 months out of the year isn't enough to have someone become fluent. But I think it's interesting just doing research on different types of methods to learn your language. There's websites you can go to, you can order tapes, you can order books or take classes and go to revivals or whatever you want to call them for speaking your language. So I think it's pretty interesting though that I hear a lot of similarities between Tsimshian and Tlingit just from you, just from talking to you now, is I see a lot of that common in Huna as well, not just place, that place is like similar a lot to where a lot of the elders that are passing away are taking the language and the cultural knowledge with them.
Right.
So it's not being passed on the way it should be or understood the way we should understand it.
Right. See, my knowledge base in the cultures is at best fragmented. Very weak in my understanding of the language, very weak in every aspect of it, you know, because like I said, it was taken away. You know, we lived without it, our grandparents, grandparents, and us, and then even subsequent generations, you know. So you're talking 4 or 5 decades, you know, of non-usage. And then a lot of it can be lost because it's not used, not practiced. And like what happened with my parents, some of my parents said, hey, it's time to get them back. And they had to send a committee over to BC or British Columbia and talk with a lot of those people over there. And even then, even that didn't produce the level of knowledge, I think, that they originally went over there, because a lot of those people don't know either. So it's dying over there too. So you know, that's another strike against the recovery. But I still hope, because what happened to our people is the culture came back, you know, in a lot of its traditional ways, except the language. So if that comes back, maybe there's a chance that the language part will come back. You know, that's something that's going to is something your generation is going to have to come up with in younger. Okay. So I'm fearful for it. You know, I'm sure hopeful. I'm progressed long enough in my life that I don't think that I'll see that come to pass. Based on my knowledge base, I don't think I'm not gonna see it, nor do I see it based on my knowledge of what's happened today that it'll even have a chance of coming back. You look at all the different cultures, Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian, Athabaskan, even up here, you know, and supposedly they had a better chance of keeping their cultures intact, better than we did, because they actually didn't have it taken away from them. It just was a lack of interest in the younger generation, that the way they lost it. They, you know, actually didn't lose, it just went backwards for a while. Just kind of hanging on, you know, it's still sliding backwards. And, I want to, before I'm gone, to get to the point that I can use it to the level of understanding if I hear somebody speaking. You look at all these potlatches, like up here, the elder that speaks it, he'll talk it in their language, but he has to say what he said in Athabaskan, he has to say it all over in English for the people to know, and the majority of the people out there, to know what he said. And I'm talking to, you know, these guys are 80, late 70s, early 80s, that know how to speak. And they don't have time to show the younger people. And then the other thing against them is that the younger generation is so embedded now in the new culture, the modern culture, that they're not going to want to go back. What good is it going to do them? That's their thinking. So all we're going to do is document all this, and those that are able to speak, and they speak it, it's going to be in the history books for a while, on tape, video, and CD, and DVD, and all that, for many years to come, but as far as actual use of it, it's not going to, I don't think it's going to come back. But the best we can do is just document it all as much as we can. That's going to be, to me, at best, it's going to be just bits and pieces that's going to be documented. Sad, but that's the way I see it. That's my own personal view, based on what I experience in my life. But like I say, when the Tsimshian culture came back to Metlakatla, that I thought would never happen. You know, when it came back to the level that it is now. Not now, my hope is that same thing happens to the language. Any language down there, higher than him, like the same way. There's a lot of attempts on the part of individuals trying to accomplish this, but, you know, it's like, they're just too few, far between them. These people are trying to do this. That's something I didn't really understand. And you know, the Spanish people. No, they're not the dominant. They're big. A lot of people still use their language. They still use it fluently, and they use it at least as much as they use English, if not more so. How did that happen? You got to look at them and say, how did you guys do that? How did your language survive and continue to seem to thrive, you know, in the modern culture? Maybe from that we can determine, you know, with that kind of information help us develop our own survival.
I think with the Alaskan Native languages, there's really no excuse as to why you wouldn't be able to learn it, because there's so many resources out there, whether it's on the computer or at a corporation or even in your home.
Mm-hmm.
Even back home, we have people learning how to speak the language, or just like translating it. You have the songs written in Tlingit, and then you have flip the page, and there it is in English.
Yeah.
And that way you know what each word means. So ideally, people are learning the language, but it's only through song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only certain phrases they know. So I think that in a way is helping, but when it comes down to it, somebody opening a ceremony in Tsimshian will have to translate it into English as well, because so few will recognize certain words or they won't understand it. And I think that's the biggest problem for a lot of Alaskan cultures is the language.
Yeah.
The artwork, and artwork basically is thriving, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But the language is still trying to get there.
Right.
'Cause with the artwork you can learn it a lot easier than trying to speak your language.
Mm-hmm.
You can sit there and study it and study it and just watch people, but try and learn your language, it's a whole new level trying to reach instead of drawing or copying somebody.
I had an uncle that tried to develop a written version of the Tsimshian language. He spent a lot of years at it. I don't know how, I can't say that he was successful at it. He was a secretary of treasury in the North Cala Council for years and years. He tried to develop, see, most of the there's no writing. You know, you look at the Tlingit language, you look at the Eskimos and Athabascans, none of it's written down. There's no, like the English language, it was all in written and writing, so it's documented and it stays there. And you draw on it, and it's always documented. One form or another, through business, through schools, through everything. It's all either put down on tape or written language or some kind of a sound medium. So it's never going to die. So we don't have that same setup with these languages, native languages. Maybe that's something that can be pursued by your generation, to see that something like that happens. I sure wished I, all my adult life, I wished I could have learned it. I said, up here, there was nobody I could have used it with. You know, being one of very few Tsimshians up here. And all those other ones, they didn't think like me, you know, trying to learn this, so there would never be anybody I could talk to about policing unless I went home. But even that is very limited.
There's another thing I was interested in too. Just watching that video about the dedication of the totem pole, I didn't hear anything about like clan leaders. Do you guys have clan leaders in your culture too?
Not per se. It's usually we rely on the elders as being leaders. So they'd be looking to me. After the last potlatch I went to down there in the southeast, I felt funny because they looked at me like an elder. And I didn't feel like it, you know, because I don't understand it. I felt, you know, lacking in knowledge about our culture. And on that basis, I didn't think I was qualified to be considered a leader. Position of leadership. I don't understand fully that. You know, like I said, mine is fragmented, my knowledge is fragmented on our culture. Really weak. But I would say predominantly my generation is that way. You know, so what we got to pass on to our kids and grandkids and great-grandkids is not a very high level of knowledge, unfortunately. You know, a lot of it's not our doing. You know, like I say, the missionaries and the federal government had a big part in that.
So, you guys don't really have clan leaders, you just rely on the elders,
mm-hmm.
So like, who are knowledgeable in the culture, you look to for...
Yeah, just like that guy that spoke at the Arna booth. He's a younger group of my dad's generation. There ain't that many of them left. And he's in his 80s now. My dad, when he died, he was 86, and that was 6 years ago. So he'd been 92 now. So those kind of people are quickly being lost. I got a mother-in-law in my former marriage, who I love very deeply, you know. I remember her using language. She gave us a lot of our Indian names. I don't remember mine, but you know, every time we went down to see her, we'd go down and she would always cook for us. You know, the entire family. We were all Indian food, so crabs, fish, potatoes, you know, all the different kinds of seafood. She cooked that all up and then we'd gather out. Well, you know, from the great-grandkids on up to the adults now of all these families. Packed that house full. It was like that all the time. Now she's old, she can't do that anymore. And during those times we had those gatherings like that, she would assign names, Indian names to all the kids that were there that didn't have any. And we try to stress to the mothers and fathers, what they are, and try to get them to know. I'll bet if I go down there and talk to those, you know, those adults now and ask them what that child's Indian name was, they would be able. But it's things like that, you know, that point out the sad part of the loss of our suffering from the languages. There's just not enough people there now. know, the one that I know, she's almost as old as I am. And I'll be 69 here next December. Even their age group is diminishing rapidly.
I think when it comes to every culture, especially in Alaska, you can tell like what parts of Alaska were hit hard by the missionaries or what generations were influenced by the missionaries, because just reading more and more about the arrival of the missionaries, you can see that mostly it was coastal people that I noticed, like towards the Aleutians all the way down to the southeast area, that were predominantly hit by the missionaries. And a lot of them were told not to practice their culture, whether it was through art, dance, performance, or the language. But I don't know, I can just really see how it affected the native people, because a lot of us don't speak the language.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in that generation are ashamed to speak their language. They were taught that it was wrong, and you got some people that still know how to speak it, but they're not as fluent as they were before, because they still won't speak it because they feel shame for speaking it. Because my mom, I considered her fluent, but even now she's not remembering that much because she doesn't use it, because my dad can't speak it, and my brothers and sisters, and most of the elders that do speak it, she doesn't socialize with them. So even herself, she's losing that cultural knowledge about the language, which is what she grew up speaking until she got sent off to school too. So I guess I'm understanding more now, just from reading and researching, that people are just ashamed of using their language because they're taught that it was wrong. And I think it's sad though that they wanted to erase that part of their memory because they're ashamed, but there's so much that goes into what the missionaries did that puts that feeling in them, to where now they're finally trying to use it or get back their native ways of life instead of being shamed of it.
There's been a turnaround among the modern people. There's a lot of them that are, you know, they know what you know about it now, that their ancestors had a hand in downgrading and giving our culture a bad time. But when it turned it around, we're starting to see a lot of that. So they're all saying that was a mistake, that their grandparents or great-grandparents, you know, those are those that were missionaries and stuff like that. Right. So maybe that'll help. There's a big push now to see if this can survive. I don't see enough of an effort, though. You know, it's more of a, you know, like when somebody's ready to die and you're doing everything you can, after a while it's just a kind of a formally stuff that you're taking away with no chance of knowing, no chance that this thing can live. You know, so they're just making it try to make it easy. Because it really doesn't have a chance to survive. Mm. The only thing that I could see happen is that all this will be memorialized, just like we do with the dead. They'll put up, you know, when people buy, they put up a cross, or they put their name on a gravestone. That's the kind of thing that I think is going to happen to a lot of our cultures. Again, that's my opinion. So I hope subjects change.
I think culturally, though, through the artwork, it's still staying alive. You see more and more people learning the older ways and making their own tools. And what I thought was interesting in that video was that David Boxley and the rest of the carvers that did the totem pole had that song and dance for their tools. I thought that was pretty interesting because I've never seen or heard about a dance for carving. That was pretty cool because he told them, put your tools out and you're going to go find them. He was describing what they were going to be doing, and that was pretty, I thought that was really neat that they had a song for the carving, like for the artists, because that is a big part of the culture, and presenting a totem pole to a family is even a bigger accomplishment, let alone finishing it. So I don't know if they did that before, or is that a new thing, just making a song for the carvers, or did they have that for like carving and fishing and stuff?
Boxley probably wrote that himself, because he's written a lot of songs. They're trying to, just like what I noticed up here in the interior, that some of those songs that they sing now are probably hundreds of years old. You know, they're way back, they're written by Sunday, you know, a long, long time ago, but they've been passed on generation to generation through the media of podlatches. Even like down in Minto, all the kids know them all. They could sing all night and not sing one, you know, not repeat any song. They know so many of them. Just one night, you know, boom, boom, boom. You know, kids from that tall to the elders. And when they get going, man, they're all out there, you know, just giving their 110% to the dancer. You see those chips almost till they drop. You just go one right after another. Boom, boom, boom. Just drench. See an hour or so of dancing steady like that. They're happy. They're doing something that their ancestors did thousands of years ago. Maybe the modern version of it, but yet it's somewhere in that version, it's the old ways are better. They even got some modern songs. There's one about the airplane. There's one about the twist, the dance. You know, the song in the native tongue. I thought that was pretty neat. But those are, you know, new songs that kind of been developed. There's songs written all the time. They're not written down, you know, like the sense of writing now. It's just that they'll get together and generate a song, or somebody will, like a memorial podcast, somebody will generate that song and come up with the lyrics first and then attach a tune to it. They may use an old tune, to revise it in such a way that it's related to that song, that the lyrics are tied to give it its own characteristics, its own identity. So that, you know, people down the road sing it, it's going to be different.
I noticed in the video too, I think it was during taking the totem pole, they were singing the entrance song. That's what I know it as, the entrance mm-hmm. song. And I don't know if that's Simshian or Haida or Tlingit, but we use that song. I didn't know that all three Southeast cultures use that song, except for Simshian way, it was sung a little different from the way we sing it or the way mm-hmm. the Haidas sing it. And it made me wonder, like, is that a older song that was used by great-grandparents or when they would go visiting these mm-hmm. towns, because all three cultures use that song. And I was mm-hmm. wondering, like, where its roots come from, like, did the Simshian write that, or the Haida, or the Tlingit, or did we get it from up here? Because I know in cultures, like, you can ask permission of the Athabaskan people, or the Haida people, or Simshian people to use their song, or that clan song. So I was wondering, like,
that was really, at one time, really strictly adhered to, you know, that of what most important, that you get the permission of people that wrote that song and you can use it in any gathering, you know. But it's not adhered to that strongly anymore. Because I get the sense, you know, like when we go down to, like we go down to Canacross on one time, my wife and I went down there. There was one song they sang, they said, oh, that's a Minto song. And they're claiming it as their own. Mm. That's not right. So she was kind of perturbed about that. I didn't know what, you know, to make of it myself, because it didn't bother me one way or the other, because I don't know. It's one of the songs she used to sing all over, you know, while she was growing up. No mental, you know, because that's where they used to live at one time. When she was a little girl, she heard it back then. But I see, because of the fragmentation of the cultures up here, you know, how that slips by. For instance, some of them had married, some of them up here might have married down there somewhere. They got taken down there that way by that person.
That's another thing that I like about all the cultures in Alaska. Like, you hear a song being sung by a different culture, but you really like it, and you ask permission to sing that song. You can, it's sort of like the language dialect, old and new, because when we sing a song, we sort of, I guess in a way, change it, and we sing it differently. Because I know in the dance group back home that I belong to, we sing the Haida gathering song, and the way we sing it, then when the, at celebration, the Haida bird group will perform it, they sing it a lot different, and it's just, I don't know, you can sort of tell that each culture adds their own little twist to it, but there's a lot of song trading going on, I guess, if you want to call it trading or giving permission of to use, and a lot of that practice still goes on, but occasionally you'll hear a group, just like you mentioned, singing a song, saying it's their song, when it's this other town or village or this person's song. So I guess it just goes back to, like, proper use of getting permission or passing of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much of that I don't understand about. I guess I can understand you need permission to use that song, but just let alone if it is a Tlingit song, but it's from Angoon or Sitka or Klokwan, you still have to get permission.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I thought, like, well, we're all Tlingit, we can use the song, but you gotta get permission to use it, because that's a different, in a way, a different dialect, a different clan or group that made that song. It's not your people, but in a way it still is your people, because it's a Tlingit song. So I didn't understand that, because my parents, we live in Hoonah, but they're from Haines and Klokwan.
Mm-hmm.
And I know all the songs by heart from Hoonah, but when I go to Klokwan, I know some of the songs, but it's harder to switch back and forth from my grandma's songs to my other grandma's songs, because I grew up in Hoonah with my grandparents,
mm-hmm.
my dad's parents. My mom's parents grew up in Haines and Klokwan, so I just think it's interesting. I can see a difference between my Hoonah culture and my Klokwan Haines
mm-hmm.
culture.
That's the same way up here. If they have a potlatch in Memento, there's some people from Benatai and Beaver and all the different villages, they all come down to that Memento. And they'll all sing the same songs. They'll sing their own individual songs. You know, it's at the very beginning of the potlatch down there, early on in the day, say everybody gathers at the longhouse at 6 o'clock. Somebody will start singing a song from one of these villages. They're going there, start beating a drum. Going away, and they're really singing, and they all get up and they start dancing too. And members of the other village will come in and mix in with them and join them. They know that song too. The only way you can tell they know is the way it ends. They know exactly when the end ends and how it ends. And they all end up together. Because all the songs that are known by mentors, they all know, you know, the whole thing goes. And then just, I don't know, maybe they repeat a song several times, you know, when they're singing it, and then finally they just find one. They are all beaten, and the drummer knows, and all the singers that are there, the men and women, the kids, they all know in advance. That's the way with all of them. I haven't figured it out myself, because I don't know. And I've seen it happen all the time. Even those that are inter-tribe, you know, from different areas. I don't know. When I used to go to a gathering called the Nuchilawoya. I don't know what that stands for, but it's an Athabaskan word, down in Tanana, all up and down the Yukon, down to Kalina, down to further down, Nalato. People from all those places, Ruby and Cockbrines and Alt River, Rampart and Beaver and Stevens Village and all that. All this one time of the summer, they spent a whole week in town for a potlatch, and they had all kinds of games, you know, competitions, you know, foot races, boat races, everything going on there, and they feed every day. People are always from different areas bringing all that food together, you know, they cook it all, give it all out. And this went on for a week. We participated in, when I was boat racing, went down there and one overnight, we overnighted there. We'd stop overnight and head back up to Fairbanks. and start to reason for others, go to town and come back the next day. Help celebrate down there. You know, they have dances and all that stuff. Even the, you know, the modern dances. Jitterbug and all that stuff. Then we come back the next day, finish the race. But they did that all the baseball games and all kinds of different kind of games. No one's heard or seen them before. But they've been doing it for all these centuries. And the one I like to see was that grease pole. You stick a skinned, debarked pole over the water, 20 feet out in the water, like a tree about that big. They grease it all up after they take the skin off, the bark. They put a $20 bill at the end of it. Everybody's trying to walk out there slow and easy, fall off. And you lose your chance when you fall off. Everybody tries it, somehow take a money start at it, slide as far as they can on foot, you know, all the way out and try to grab it as they fall off. Some guy, somebody would eventually figure it out, you know. It's a lot of fun. They have canoe races. All kinds of foot races, all kinds of games, like I said, I've never seen before. But like I said, it was all participated with all these different villages up and down here. That's quite a long, you know, down the ladder. That's 200-300 miles down that way, another 150 miles up to Rampart, maybe more than that, I don't know where it is. It all come down there. Everybody's camping their tents all along. You see just hundreds of tents. That time was neat.
I know up in this area, I always hear people talk about fish camps. Did you guys ever have fish camps too?
Yeah. My wife put on a pod last week. We established a fish camp up in just below the bridge that goes across the Yukon. We fish up there a lot now. We get a lot of our salmon that we have for the winter. I freeze most of mine. I've got 5 freezers full of fish and moose.
Mm-hmm.
And various other things like stuff that we get from Southeast. But we give a lot of it away, you know, we participate in a lot of the potlatches, so everybody donates, and that's what we do. In fact, we gather a lot of, most of what we put up for the winter is going to go to that. All this potlatch is going on all winter long, all year round, in fact. We've got to make sure we have enough food, I think. Everybody does that, you know, takes. Most of what we give is the fish.
I like that part of the culture too, because whether you were family with that person or you knew them or they were your friend, it seems like everybody comes together to help.
Mm-hmm.
And people do put up food just knowing that, well, so-and-so is going to be having a party or a potlatch. And you need a lot of that, just harvesting in general for yourself and for your family and for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Always a lot of fridges or freezers full for the winter.
Yeah.
So I like doing that too. My parents just went, they're in Haines right now still. They just had a party and that we were preparing last summer. I wasn't there this past summer, but the summer before, we got everything, jarred stuff, and they were doing that this past summer too, so we start preparing like 2 years in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Just to
it took us 2 years to prepare for my wife's potlatch that she gave for her daughter. And it was non-stop work. all summer long, you know, goes up to Yukon, down on Tana, down to Chitlin, down to Kenai. We got clams, everything. You know, brought up seaweed from back home, and fish eggs, you know, herring eggs.
Yeah.
All that stuff we brought together. So, because of me, a lot of these people got introduced to a lot of Southeast stuff, the way we do.
I like herring eggs. You get some people that don't know what they are.
Yeah.
At the Native Arts Center, they had
a lot of those people in Mentor, you know, that had it for the first time because I bought it. You know, they really like it.
I love herring eggs. Because I took a class with Alvin Amison here at the Native Arts Center, and this girl from back home brought herring eggs. And I was like, ooh. People were like, what are those? And I was like, they're herring eggs. And they're looking at them. And I was like, I was going to try and be polite and let people dish up, but nobody touched them. It was a big bowl. And I was like, put a whole bunch on because they're just looking at them. And I guess, like, it's the same way I look at a guluk or whatever they call them. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'll try it, but I was like, I don't know. And I got them to try the herring eggs too. And they're like, we heard of it before, but.
Well, my wife's the same way with Southeast stuff, like Greece.
Yeah.
She don't dare touch it. She won't even try it. What else? There was other things. I guess mainly it was that. Eggs too, herring eggs she wouldn't eat. She did have to take Ulligans. We had smoked Ulligans one time that my dad made it. Because my dad, you know, we're down there. Because my dad brought it to the table and served us, she had to take it. She had no choice. But she learned to like it. She liked it.
I think that's kind of funny. Like, there's stuff that we'll eat down there we think is normal because we were raised on it, but then we come up here and we're like,
yeah,
wrinkle your nose a little, but then you try it and you like it. And it's the same with them because we get a lot of stuff that interior people don't really get as often. So I'll try, but at first I'll be like, no.
I'm still that way with muktuk.
Yeah.
I don't know, I had a bad experience with when I was in Mount Edgecombe. They had some down in the main kitchen. I was working in the hospital that was right after high school. It was our job to take the food carts up to the different levels, the floor levels, and they had heated plug-in heat carts, portable carts. You could call these little, up to each floor level on the elevator. And I was coming down with one of these carts one time, and I seen this, what looked to me like cake. It wasn't cut up yet. And I thought it was, you know, pink cake with chocolate color. But I just took a glance, and I was trying to, you know, do some more of my work that involved just coming down there and getting right back up to the floor level where I was working. I see them, I grab a piece of the food in my mouth, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. You know, to this day, I haven't tried it since. But I ran into a lot of Athabascan people here that love it. I got a friend that just loves it. The reason I'm saying that is I'm going to